From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with actor Joe Mantegna. He's probably the leading interpreter of David Mamet's writing. He stars in Mamet's new film, Homicide. And in Godfather 3, Mantegna played Joey Zaza, the mobster with the $2,000 suits. Also today, photographing the dead. It may seem ghoulish now, but in the 19th and early 20th centuries, it was a common practice for families to memorialize their dead with photographs. We talk with Dr. Stanley Burns, who has edited a book of memorial photography. And if you remember being drilled in school on the difference between can I and may I, you'll be interested in hearing what linguist Jeff Numberg has to say on the subject. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Robert Gates, President Bush's choice as Director of Central Intelligence, was confirmed today by a vote of 64-31. Gates received the approval of the Senate despite concerns about his knowledge of the Iran-Contra scandal and charges that he tailored intelligence estimates. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
48-year-old Robert Gates has been confirmed as the 15th director of the CIA. Gates was nominated to the post 6 months ago, but was first nominated 5 years ago by President Ronald Reagan. He withdrew his name after questions were raised about what he knew about the diversion of funds to the Nicaraguan Contras. Today, those who opposed him, including Majority Leader George Mitchell, said there were still too many lingering doubts.
Too many unanswered questions remain about this nominee's credibility and this nominee's judgment.
But those who supported Gates, including 21 Democrats, pledged to watch the agency closely under his leadership. Senator David Boren, chairman of the Intelligence Committee, said he'd make sure that employees who came forward to publicly oppose Gates would not suffer retaliation. That promise, said Mitchell, is proof that Gates is the wrong man at the wrong time. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Voters in Pennsylvania have another hour before polls close. They're choosing between former U.S. Attorney General Richard Thornburgh and interim Democratic Senator Harris Wofford. The winner will fill the seat vacated last spring by the death of Senator John Hines. The latest polls show the two are running neck and neck. Polling places in Washington state are jammed as voters face controversial initiatives on abortion, euthanasia, term limitations for elected officials, and property taxes. Tom Bonzi of Washington Public Radio reports from Seattle.
Election officials predict they'll set a new turnout record for an off-year election in Washington state. Voters are going to the polls in droves to judge controversial ethical and social issues. John Kenny is an election inspector at a precinct in northeast Seattle.
Voting started at 7, and for the first time in several years, we had about 15 people waiting about 10 minutes to 7.
And voting's been heavy ever since. A citizens initiative that would legalize doctor-assisted suicide is drawing many people to the polls, as is a proposition to limit the terms of state and congressional politicians. Abortion is on the ballot in the form of a measure that seeks to put the abortion rights guarantees of the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision into state law. For National Public Radio, I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
British Prime Minister John Major says billionaire Robert Maxwell will be missed. Maxwell was found dead in the waters off the Canary Islands today. He reportedly fell from his 180-foot luxury yacht. Stocks close lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 14 points to finish at 3031.31. This is NPR News. The governors of the Postal Service have voted to keep the price of a first-class stamp at 29 cents. The board today debated raising the cost by 1 cent. But Postmaster General Anthony Frank says holding the line now means the next increase, possibly as much as a nickel, will probably come a year earlier than planned. Frank says there could be an increase in early 1994 and another in 1997 or 98. A new congressional report says if the U.S. collects all the money it's been pledged by its allies to pay for the Gulf War, it will have made a profit on the operation. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from the Capitol.
According to the General Accounting Office, if the allies come through with all the contributions pledged, the United States will receive $800 million more than it paid for the war. Burden sharing, Making sure the Allies helped pay for a military effort the United States led was a prominent issue when it looked like the conflict could drag on. But when the war ended swiftly and decisively, the issue of cost received less attention. On October 31st, the Pentagon announced that Saudi Arabia still owes about $2.5 billion of the $16.8 billion it had pledged. Kuwait was still in arrears for about $2 billion of the $16 billion promised. Japan, Germany, South Korea, and other countries owed smaller amounts of money. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Bad weather is still gripping much of the nation. Schools are closed in Michigan, and thousands are still without power in Minnesota and Wisconsin because of an Arctic cold front. Forecasters say it may get a little warmer as the front moves eastward from Montana. Cold temperatures are helping slow some of the arson fires that have charred more than 250,000 acres in 9 Appalachian states. More than 1,000 fires have burned over 250,000 acres in 9 Appalachian states since the end of last month. At least 590 fires have burned more than 200,000 acres in West Virginia. Fires are out in some other states. I'm Doreen McAllister, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In my opinion, for what it's worth, Joe Mantegna is one of the best American actors today. He's also probably the leading interpreter of David Mamet's writing. Mantegna starred on Broadway in Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross and Speed the Plow. He starred in David Mamet's films House of Games, Things Change, and the new film Homicide. You may also know Mantegna as Joey Zaza, the elegantly dressed mobster in Godfather III. In Woody Allen's film Alice, Mantegna was the saxophonist Mia Farrow has an affair with. In the new film Homicide, Mantegna plays a detective who has no life outside his work. He's close to no one but his partner. His greatest gift as a cop is as a talker, the cop with the silver tongue who can persuade anyone to cooperate. The role is perfect for Mantegna because he, more than any other actor I can think of, uses his voice to show the musicality of how people speak. And Mamet writes dialogue that turns colloquial speech into poetry. In this scene, Mantegna is talking to the mother of a killer, trying to convince her that the only way to save her son is to turn him in.
Listen to me. I know that it stinks. I know that there's so much death in the world. I know that it's full of hate, Mama. I know that it all turns out wrong. Here we are. Here we are. We're the garbage men. You think I don't know that? I know that. Looking for something to love. You got something to love. You got your boys. That's something. Look in my eyes. I want to save your son. Before God, I want to save your boy. Will you help me?
After hearing Joe Mantegna in scenes like that, I wanted to know if he thinks of his lines in a musical way and how he thinks out where the accents and pauses will be in each line.
I studied acting for a couple of years at the Goodman School of Drama, which was the Goodman School of Drama, is now DePaul University here in Chicago. And one of the more beneficial courses there was, you know, scoring a script and being able, in other words, to take the material and read it like a piece of music and understand, make notations and understand that if when you're given a certain sentence, there's a variety of ways that sentence could be delivered, depending, of course, on which word you're going to emphasize or just the lilt of your voice or this, that, and the other. Because David Mamet has obviously put a lot of attention into writing just the right wording and the right punctuation to get his point across. So it is intentional, and I appreciate writing that's done with that much thought, because it forces me to give it more attention and give it more respect, so you're not so cavalier about, you know, what you're saying.
Do you ever improvise within a Mamet script, or is everything, you know, as it is in the text?
Well, I would say that improvisation in terms of the dialogue is pretty minimal and should be.
Why should it be?
Because you wouldn't. Some writers write with the freedom for verbal improvisation in there. I've worked for Woody Allen. Now, with Woody, he will give you that freedom. In other words, but it's intentional. In other words, Woody will write his dialogue, but it isn't written totally in stone. And, of course, coming from working a lot with Mamet, as I have, my initial reaction when I first was working with Woody was I would give him exactly every word he has written it. You know, I'd improvise in terms of my delivery and things like that, as I do with any material. But he, early on, like at first or second day of shooting, I remember him saying to me, he says, oh, listen, Joe, you know, don't feel like you're locked to these words. You know, if you want to add some stuff or you just want to go with it or, you know, change this, that, or the other, that's fine. Go ahead and do it. And so, oh, well, okay, once I had that signal from him, then there were instances where I would, you know, vamp or riff or whatever words you want to use for it as to making alterations as to what I'm saying. But that's Woody's style. That's the way he works, and that's how he writes. Of course, if he wasn't getting what he wanted, he'd be the first one to say, well, maybe don't say that. Say something else.
Right.
But where with David, it's a different ballgame because he just writes differently. He's a man who has specifically, I mean, he writes in iambic pentameter, so it's not unless a person naturally speaks that way, it would be a little risky to just say, well, I know you wrote this line, Dave, but I think I'll say it this way. No, that's not the way you do it. I mean, it's the same thing, again, making that Shakespeare analogy. If you're doing a sonnet from Shakespeare, you don't say, well, here, let me just put this in my own words. I think it'll sound better.
Is Homicide written in iambic pentameter?
I mean, I haven't sat down with a metronome and counted out, but I would say yes. I mean, I would think that everything he's written is within those rhythms. I mean, I don't know how strictly he adheres to it, and it's not important. It's just like good music. You don't, if you really enjoy it, you don't stop and say, well, you know, wait a minute, that's a 4-4 beat or a 2-4 beat, or you know what I mean? It's how he wrote it, the rhythms he has written it in shouldn't be so obvious that it becomes a glaring, noticeable thing. It's a thing that's just there, and it's part of the beauty of the material.
Well, you know, you play a cop who's very alienated both from, I mean, the guy's got no family, he's got no personal life, he's really seems to have no friends outside of his partner, and he's even alienated from a lot of the cops that he works with. And in the last scene particularly, all of that alienation, because there's been a couple of final betrayals, really register on your face. And I was really wondering what you were thinking about during the shooting of that last scene to get that kind of dazed alienation on your face.
Well, I tell you, it all led toward that. I mean, playing that role, it was a monumental role for me. It was the most difficult role I've ever played, and certainly in film, partly because I'm in, outside of the first minute of the movie, I'm in every frame. And that translates into working 12-hour days, day in, day out, consistently, week after week, under very harsh conditions, in very unpleasant environments, dealing with some very serious and disturbing things. And that starts to wear on you after a while. So it really wasn't that difficult in a way to draw on those kinds of emotions and to maybe let those emotions seep out through my expressions, my demeanor, whatever the camera happens to pick up. I think when you're that embroiled in it, that kind of stuff starts to seep out through you. I felt that it did for me anyway, whether or not it was effective and if people, you know, pick up on that in seeing the movie, you know, great. But in a way, you control some part of it, but a lot of it I had no control over, and it was okay because I felt a lot like this person, this Bobby Gold. I even told David when we wrapped the film that of all the characters I've played for him, this was the one I was going to miss the most because I liked the man very much.
Yet you seem so different from him. I mean, you've been married a long time. You have two children. You seem to really, you know, like having a family. Everybody, you know, when I read about you, everybody has such wonderful things to say about you and how you'd never say anything bad about anybody else and how nobody has anything bad to say about you. Well, so it seems like such the opposite picture of this kind of isolated, alienated fellow that you play.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, I enjoy my life. I mean, my family, my friends, I feel I live a very fortunate life. And I feel blessed to have that life. But yet I think all of us, even those of us who have been so fortunate to have had, you know, a wonderful life, there is that little bit in them, that isolated thing, that almost that not quite sure how to phrase it, but it's like you're born alone and you die alone, that almost kind of thing in you that says, I mean, we used to joke about it with a phrase of, hey, you know, we're all in this alone. And there's some truth to that, so that it's not so difficult to get into that mindset, you know, if kind of forced to, when I mean forced, meaning you're playing a character and the dialogue and the writing and everything orchestrates itself to put you in a bag that's very different than what you really are, perhaps, as a person, because I still feel we all have these kinds of aspects of, you know, no matter how fraternal we are, how much family we have, there's that solitary person that is ourselves that's, you know, we have to still deal with. And it's just tapping on that you know, the loneliness of those times that we've all been lonely in our lives. And so it's just tapping on that and expanding on it and creating a character who's pretty much wrapped around in my case, let's say, the Joe Mantegna, who's had these very lonely, isolated moments in his life, and just stringing them together and saying, now this is a guy who's had a hell of a lot more of them.
Can you think of one of those moments that you're thinking of in your life that you'd be able to share publicly?
Well, I, as I'm thinking about it now, I remember it was about 20 years ago, I just starting off my professional career as an actor. I was in my early 20s. And I remember it was a holiday. I think it was it was my birthday. That's what it was. It was my birthday, and things were all going actually very well for me. But my birthday's in November in Chicago. That's a pretty cold month. And for whatever reasons, and I can't even remember specifically why, there was nobody around for my birthday. And I remember I was in my apartment, and it wasn't a bad time in my life. As I said, I was working, things were happening, but for whatever reasons, there was nobody around. I wasn't involved with anybody at that time. And I remember sitting in my apartment, I was eating some tuna fish casserole that I had made for myself. And I remember sitting there eating it thinking, I guess I should be doing something. I should go out somewhere and do something. It's my birthday. I think I was 22, 23 years old. And I remember this terrible feeling of loneliness, of like just wanting to talk to somebody or just share something with somebody. And obviously it did have some impact on me for me to recall what I was even eating at that time.
Yeah.
And to be able to tell you right now. So thinking of moments like that and thinking that this is a character that perhaps has spent a lot of birthdays doing that and a lot of holidays doing that, that helps you really tap into certain kinds of feelings for, you know, the character, a guy who basically lives for his career, who lives for his job, and that's the only thing that gets all of his attention, and everything else is just his own personal life is a long string of eating tuna casseroles by himself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joe Mantegna, and he stars in the new movie Homicide, which was written and directed by David Mamet. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Mantegna, and he stars in the new movie Homicide. He also co-starred in Godfather 3 and in Alice, House of Games, Things Change, and other films. I want to ask you about your role in Godfather 3. You played Joey Zaza, the gangster with the finest suits, and he's taken over the illegitimate Corleone business interests, and his people are dealing drugs, and he's basically going to war with the Corleone family. Did you feel a special sense of occasion working on Godfather 3? Because Godfather 1 and 2 have been such an important part of our lives, you know? I mean, they're such great films. And you know, to like make another sequel, especially after so many years, everybody's going to wonder, well, does it measure up or not? But one way or another, it's an occasion mm-hmm. to film another Godfather film.
Yes. Whether, going into it, you know, people, you can say to yourself, well, is this going to measure up? You know, is it going to even measure up to, in my mind, in other words, because for me, Godfather 1 and 2 exist as two of the greatest films ever made. I mean, period. But that, while it enters your mind for a moment, beyond that, my feeling was, it doesn't matter. I don't care. That's not the point. That's, I'm going to be doing Godfather 3. I'm going to be part of that team that's going to complete this trilogy. And my feeling was, it's going to be, you know, I'm in good hands. I'm in, you know, I'm with the man who created this thing, you know, Francis Coppola. We're going to do this movie. I'm going to work with these people that I've watched in this saga over the last, you know, almost 20 years. So it was a great, great thrill for me to be part of it. And it's a great thrill for me now, having done it, to be a part of it. And I'm very proud of that movie. And I think it's a wonderful, wonderful movie. And I think it's a fitting end to that trilogy of films.
Yeah, I like the film a lot, too.
Yeah, I really do. I mean, I think it took some shots that I think were almost, I think in retrospect, in other words, down the line, I think it will find its niche, in other words, within that framework of those three films. And it's, to me, it is the appropriate ending to that saga. And I'm very grateful to have been a part of it.
I thought you had exactly the right amount of kind of menace and style and all that kind of like public relations flair that that certain gangsters have.
Well, I felt that Francis, in a way like Mamet, writes and directs in a certain kind of a style. And for me, his style is almost operatic and almost regal. I mean, there's a scene in Godfather 3. It's a scene that I'm in and at the it's supposed to be a meeting of all the dons in Atlantic City. And there's a scene where they're passing around a table with jewelry and they're each picking, you know, rings or whatever things of value as to be taking as tribute almost, as gifts. I mean, that scene itself to me struck me as being so ancient Rome or something right out of, you know, the Renaissance. It had a majesty to it. And to me, that was how I tried to key into my character, that even though it's very contemporary, it's, you know, it's now, it's America, it's this world of gangsters and, you know, cops and robbers and whatever. But yet underneath that, there's a certain kind of style and sense of almost, you know, regal royalty kind of thing. You know, these are the princes and dukes and earls of this profession. And that's what I found really interesting about it.
I say to all of you, I have been treated this day with no respect. I've earned you all money. I've made you rich, and I asked for little. Good. You will not give, I'll take. As for Don Corleone, well, he makes it very clear to me today that he is my enemy. You must choose between us.
I thought you brought some of the same musicality and style to your lines that you bring to Mamet.
Well, that may be, and maybe that was on Francis's part, it was intentional on his part, maybe to you know, have a character that had maybe something of that there. I don't know. But again, like I say, sometimes it's hard for me to separate, you know, who I am as an actor and yeah, who I am as a person. And, you know, I try not to self-examine it too much.
A lot of people assume that the Joey Zaza character that you played in Godfather 3 was in part modeled on John Gotti because they're both, you know, the mobsters with the best wardrobe, you know, with the finest suits. Did you look at any Gotti news clips or anything like that?
No, because I never used Gotti as my, you know, role model for the role. I mean, if people wanted to make those assumptions, that's fine. But my feeling was it goes much broader than that. I mean, that's an obvious comparison you could make, but yet those kinds of characters in gangland lore have existed a lot longer than the current, you know, John Gotti thing. I mean, you know, Bugsy Siegel was a very, you know, dapper, well-dressed guy. So were a lot of, you know, Legs Diamond. So in other words, that kind of fastidious, kind of well-groomed kind of character is not, you know, there's more history to that than would exist, you know, just in contemporary times. And so the clothes are different, but basically the demeanor is basically the same. You know, in other words, a guy who wears $2,000 suits is going to walk and talk and act a little differently than a guy who's wearing stuff from Kmart.
Did you know any guys who had $2,000 suits?
Oh, yeah. I know guys who have $2,000 suits. I grew up in Cicero, Illinois, so there was a lot of guys with $2,000 suits walking around. But, you know, it's helpful in the sense of being able to recall drawing on that image of guys who dressed very expensively who seemed to have nothing to do at 3 o'clock in the afternoons on weekdays, you know. So I always used to struck me as being very incongruous. It's just like, gee, my dad's at work. I wonder why he isn't.
I enjoyed the recent episode of The Simpsons that you did where you play like a neighborhood gangster and Bart becomes a wise guy. how did that come about? You're working on that show.
They pretty much just contacted me through my agent. I think they just, you know, had an idea of that kind of character and thought I might be the right actor to play it. And so it was a lot of fun for me to play a cartoon character.
How did you change your voice for The Simpsons?
I just started talking like this, that's all. Just make a little alteration and you become Fat Tony.
I mean, that's, you know, changing your voice as an actor is, you know, just as, you know, Carpenter has to change hammers once in a while, too. So it's just, you know, you make those adaptations as you need to.
You seem to be at a new stage in your career. You're much better known than you were, you know, just a couple of years ago. Is there a difference in the kind of screenplays you're being sent now and the types of roles that you're being asked to read?
Well, somewhat. I mean, I'm certainly getting more offers to do, you know, what I would have considered leading man roles, you know, years ago. And also, since I wasn't doing leading man roles years ago, it is kind of new for me. I still think of them, I think of any role as a character role, though. If it's a leading, what someone else would call a leading man role, in my attitude is, well, it's a character role of a leading man, because that's just my background. I've played all kinds of character roles all my life. So there, you know, there's more often there's roles where I get to kiss the girl, you know, which I, instead of shoot the girl, you know, which I perhaps had a bigger career doing. So it's, again, it's an ongoing evolution. I just hope to continue to be able to work with people who are at the top of their game. To me, that's the biggest thrill, to be able to work with the David Mamets, with the Coppolas, with the Woody Allens, with the Barry Levinsons, with the Peter Yates, with the Michael Apteds. That's the thrill, you know, work with Nick Nolte, work with Al Pacino. This is what anybody in any profession wants to be able to do, work at the top of their game, and that's, for me, been the ultimate thrill.
One last question. What's the difference between playing a leading man as a leading man and playing a leading man as a character actor?
Less makeup, I guess. That's all. You know, I usually tend to just walk on the set and say, no makeup here, just, you know... You know, just let me know if my hair's in my eyes and, you know, cover maybe this one little blemish that, you know, looks like it's ready to go. Outside of that, let's just wing it, you know.
You have a say in that? I'm surprised.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think when you start first starting out as an actor, you're willing to, like, just trust everybody and say, oh, yeah, go ahead, do what you will with me and throw me out there and I'll just, you know, and I won't say a word and hopefully you'll just pay me and send me home. I think later on, as you start to do it, you realize, hey, look, regardless of everybody else's input, it's your mug that's up there for, you know, maybe 50 years from now. As I'm looking at the old Bogart movies, some other little kid's going to be looking at my movies and say, that's that Joe Monte. Yeah, oh, yeah, we heard he was an actor back in the, you know, the 90s. So that's what he looked like, kind of, you know. So, no, I think it's important you have a say in that somewhat, you know.
And you don't want somebody looking at it 50 years from now saying, but how come he was wearing eyeliner under his eyes?
Yes, exactly. Jesus, you know, he doesn't seem the type to be wearing that much makeup. So, yeah, I think it's important to have some input.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been Joe Mantegna, and he stars in the new movie Homicide. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today there is a taboo against taking pictures of the dead, but in the 19th and early 20th centuries, it was a popular way for families to memorialize their dead. Dr. Stanley Burns has an archive of medical photography, and he's edited a book of memorial photography, coming up, Pictures of the Dead. Also, when our elementary school teachers tried to impress on us the difference between can I and may I, it left lots of us confused. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts about why. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Pennsylvania, voters are going to the polls in the nation's only Senate race. Former U.S. Attorney General Richard Thornburg is challenging interim Senator Harris Wofford, a Democrat appointed to fill the Senate seat of the late John Hines, who died in an airplane crash. Mike Villers of member station WHYY has more.
National party leaders trying to get a read on next year's presidential race are anxiously awaiting the outcome of today's vote, which analysts agree is too close to call. Incumbent Democrat Harris Wofford's call for national health care and anti-Washington rhetoric have closed a 40-point gap with former U.S. Attorney General Dick Thornburg. Thornburg, who also served two terms as governor of Pennsylvania, has been on the defensive for much of the campaign. This past week, he also came out for national health care, though with a less far-reaching plan than Wofford. Both sides spent heavily on negative advertising throughout the race, but reportedly held back last-minute attack ads in fear of a public backlash. In Philadelphia, I'm Mike Villers.
In other contests, the Associated Press is now projecting Democrat Brereton Jones, winner of the gubernatorial contest in Kentucky, defeating Republican Congressman Larry Hopkins. And voters in Washington State are casting ballots on imposing term limits for elected officials, along with a first-in-the-nation plan to legalize doctor-aided suicide for the terminally ill. The body of billionaire publisher Robert Maxwell was found in the Atlantic Ocean this afternoon, some 20 miles from the Canary Islands. Earlier, Maxwell had been reported missing from his yacht while cruising in the area. Officials said that Maxwell's widow and a son identified the body of the 68-year-old tycoon, who had apparently gone to sea for a break from his debt-troubled empire and a dispute about allegations that he had links to the Israeli Secret Service. President Bush said today that he opposes any major tax cut to help stimulate economic growth. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The White House has been under pressure, even from within the administration, to propose a program to get the economy moving again. Today, President Bush said he has already proposed such a program, and he blames Congress for failing to act on it.
What we've been talking about a transportation bill, about IRAs, about capital gains, about all kinds of stimulatory steps that can be taken without busting the budget agreement.
Mr. Bush also said suggestions that shoot long-term interest rates right through the roof are simply unacceptable.
Now, I'm talking about the idea of getting broad tax cuts without regard as to what it does to long-term interest rates and the budget agreement.
But the president left open the possibility that he will make other economic growth proposals. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
This is National Public Radio News. On Capitol Hill, by a vote of 64-31, the Senate has approved the nomination of Robert Gates to head the CIA. Gates was confirmed despite concern by some that he knows more about the Iran-Contra scandal than he has said. Opposition to Gates as CIA director, which threatened to defeat him when he was nominated by President Bush 6 months ago, failed to gain strength this time around. The 48-year-old Gates has served Mr. Bush as Deputy White House National Security Advisor. A Senate panel has opened 3 days of hearings into the issue of whether missing American soldiers are still being held captive from the Vietnam War. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney said that he did not think so. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Cheney says the Pentagon has studied recent photos that purport to show missing Americans alive in Southeast Asia. He says his department will pursue every lead that comes its way, but so far Cheney says investigators haven't found what they've been looking for.
To date, we have no conclusive evidence proving that Americans are being held against their will in Indochina. Nonetheless, the importance of this issue makes investigating live sighting reports our first priority.
Cheney chided Vietnam, saying the government there could do more to assist U.S. efforts to track down reports of live Americans. More than 2,000 Americans are listed as POWs or missing in action from the Vietnam War, but of those, just 109 are being treated as active cases. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Also in Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that state officials may be sued for damages if they violate the rights of others while in office. The 8-0 ruling in a Pennsylvania case could expose officials to expensive lawsuits when they are accused of violating a federal law aimed at preventing abuses of power. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's not easy to talk about death in our culture, so the idea of taking memorial photographs of dead loved ones would strike most of us as downright ghoulish. But in the last century, when death at an early age was much more common, postmortem photographs were an important way of remembering the dead for mainstream Protestant America. And in the eyes of my guest, Dr. Stanley Burns, many of these photos were quite moving. Burns is an ophthalmologist who has a medical photography archive and has edited a book of memorial photography called Sleeping Beauty. The title refers to the Victorian concept of death as a restful sleep for a redeemed soul. There are pictures of the dead in coffins, on beds, in rocking chairs, and in the arms of loved ones. Some are beautified with flowers, others are stark. Wealthy people have always been able to afford portraits, but until the 1800s, the working person did not have the means for immortalization.
With the invention of photography in 1839, a process was possible where a person could have the best memorialization conceivable, which was an actual representation of themselves. The problem was, when photography started, not everyone could have their picture on taken immediately, and the photographs were expensive. What happened was, someone would die before their photograph could get taken. So what resulted was photographer coming and taking a picture of the deceased.
If, say, a parent took a picture of a dead child, what would they like to do with the photograph? Would it be a private memory, or would it be hung on the living room wall?
Well, what started off as private memorialization, became a cultural norm. These pictures were made into lockets. They were made into wall-hanging ornaments and put into frames. Most importantly, with the advent of the paper print, many copies were made, and they were sent to all the friends and relatives so that they could see the deceased. It was a normal practice. This was not something that was hidden or shameful, as it is in the 20th century.
Now, the photographs that you've collected in the book are really fascinating. There are several where the mother is posed with the dead child on her lap. And I was saying that it seemed ghoulish to take pictures of the dead, but it seems very much against custom as we know it today to hold somebody dead on your lap and pose with them.
People in the 19th century were quite familiar with death. You died at home, you were taken care of by your loved ones, and you were buried by your loved ones. It was not unusual, therefore, for all members of the family to become extremely familiar with death. Taking a photograph, a mother or father taking a photograph with their dead child, came from the painterly tradition. There was a painterly tradition of the sick child, where there's a famous painting which became known throughout culture, and there were many representations of it, of a mother with her sick child, which was an honoring of motherhood and childhood. When children died, pictures were taken in this style, and oftentimes there's no attempt to show that the child is not dead. There are several pictures in the book where the child obviously has rigor mortis and is garlanded with flowers and other symbols of death.
Yeah, and you'd think that after rigor mortis had set in, that the child wouldn't be sitting on the mother's lap. But that's how some of the poses are. Were there no taboos about how much time could have elapsed before a photo was taken?
Well, ideally would be done as soon as possible because people were usually buried promptly. But there is one photograph in the book of a mother who was attached to her daughter that would not let her be buried, and the picture was taken 9 days after death. And actually, she looks quite well, which is surprising. Most of us today who are not familiar with death are quite surprised with the appearances in these photographs.
Well, you mentioned how the hands are sometimes a giveaway that the photograph is of a dead person. In some of the photos, the hands are tied together.
In the early era of photography, there was no attempt to beautify death of adults. That's why the book's called Sleeping Beauty. It's the story of how we all got to look like Sleeping Beauties. At the beginning of photography, the religious ethic at the time dictated that we were sinners going to hell to meet our maker. We didn't have to be prettified. And there was no attempt to beautify the pictures. For instance, because of rigor mortis, hands were tied. I have some pictures with the coins on the eyelids, with the chin straps, with all the devices that one would associate with death at the time present in the photograph. There would be pictures with blood running from the mouth and nose. And for consideration, I didn't put in the more gruesome of those types photograph, but there are quite a few. There was no attempt to beautify death in adults at the early age of photography.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Stanley Burns, and he's edited a book called Sleeping Beauty, Memorial Photography in America. There are photographs from the 19th and early 20th centuries. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Stanley Burns, and he has an archive of artistic and historical medical photos, and his new book of memorial photography comes from the archives and from other places as well. Most of the photographs in your book are photographs that were taken in the home. This was a time when people were prepared for death at home.
Well, the main home in the room, the parlor, was really the death room in the house. And people were used to preparing and taking care of each other. In the 19th century, we died at home, surrounded by our friends and relatives, and it was a completion of life. We were responsible for our loved ones. Friends and relatives came in, washed the body, and took care of it, and were all part of the mourning process.
When somebody died at home, you say that they were prepared for the funeral in the room that was known as the parlor. But once funeral parlors came into being, the name of that room was changed in the house.
That occurred in 1910 with a quick movement of the journalistic pen. Edward Bach, who was editor of the Ladies' Home Journal, had decided that death was not an important issue for the 20th century American. Because of the absolute miracles of conquest of disease, there was a great movement on and a great understanding that death itself would be conquered in the 20th century. To foster that idea, the dying of death was a common topic of discussion. And Editor Bach dictated that he would not accept the designation parlor for any room in the home that was shown or listed, portrayed in the Ladies' Home Journal, and that to go the exact opposite route, he made up the name living room. And so that when we discuss living room, we're really talking about the death room in our house.
When funeral homes, funeral parlors, were becoming more popular. What happened to the idea of taking pictures of the dead?
The idea of photographing the dead, or shall I say, died with the advent of the loss of death in America. Because of World War I, mourning was abolished, and literally abolished, just almost the same as Edward Bach's swift pen. The Queen in England, looking out over her subjects, because of the tremendous numbers of death in World War I, everyone was wearing mourning clothes, and this was not a good morale booster. So she decreed that mourning clothes would be not required, how shall I say, in society. And they were removed from society.
So when part of the mourning process died out, so did the whole idea of
the whole idea
photography?
Of taking photographs. However, because of the shamefulness and taboo of death in the 20th century, people take photographs, but they do not talk about them anymore. As a matter of fact, Ann Landers, in a column, had received from one of her relatives some postmortem pictures of a relative in a coffin. And Landers did not like the idea. And she printed it. This was her answer. However, within a short time, she received over 1,000 replies to this column and retracted the statement and reprinted some of those letters. And it turns out, as I had predicted in my book, that people are still taking postmortem photographs. It's not part of the cultural norm, but they do it because it's one of the last acts of memorialization. It's not, as I said, widely done, but it's being done, and it is being done more and more as we recognize the need to participate more in the death process.
You know, the early daguerreotype photography was not the easiest or quickest process. It's hardly like having a little, Polaroid at home. What did it entail to have somebody come in and take a photograph of a deceased relative?
Well, it actually was a big deal. The photographer had to bring his entire apparatus. Many of these pictures are extremely beautiful because you had to hold still for a while to take your photograph when you were living. Many pictures of children, especially young children, daguerreotypes, show the child moving. There's a blur in the image. It's hard to get a daguerreotype of a still child that holds still for 20 seconds or more.
Yeah, because the exposure time is so long.
Because exposure time is long. However, with the dead, you don't have to worry about exposure time. You could take your time with lighting, with positioning, and you could shoot as long as you would like with the different lighting effects. So post-mortem photographs are artistically very beautiful in many, many cases because of that fact of early photography.
Let me ask you, have you ever done anything like this yourself, or would you ever consider it?
I would consider it, but I haven't done it. I, as most Americans, have lived a good part of my life without having experienced a death. The average 20-year-old person has almost a 98 or more percent chance of not experiencing a death in their family for the next 25 years. There will be no death of children or parents. And so that death in America has become an old age process.
Not completely, especially with an epidemic like AIDS.
Well, that was one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because the present AIDS epidemic forces us to face death by disease in the prime of life. And this is for the first time in 70 years we see people die prematurely, children before parents.
Do you know if a lot of people who have lost loved ones from AIDS have been taking pictures of the deceased?
Yes, they have. It's a loving act. There's very little you could do for a dying person. And there's very little one can do in our society with the way funerals are done. And the mourning and bereavement process has been shortened so that we don't get much time to really participate in and work out our grief. Taking a photograph allows that participation and it gives you something positive, something you can keep, something you can hold in your hand. You don't have to put it on your wall, but it's there. One of the research things that I have done is talk to people who have owned photo development places. And the research has shown that whereas people take sex pictures and send them in to be developed, the same number, same percentage of death pictures are apparently running through these development places. So it is being done, it's just not being talked about. Death is our 20th century taboo and shameful topic. Personal, intimate death.
Do you find it kind of paradoxical that at this time where, as you say, we've become so kind of out of touch with death, it's taken care of by the professionals, yet death is so much more explicitly shown in fiction, you know, in the literature we read, on in the movies that we see?
Well, violent death is, and war death is part of our daily diet. I can shoot the engineer here, say, and
hey,
and I, no matter how horrible a job I did, they'd have his picture in the paper tomorrow, and they say, "Hey, look what he did," and we could show it around, and we can have it over breakfast and everything else. However, if he died right now and had a heart attack, and I took a very beautiful, loving post-mortem photograph of him after he was dead, and I showed it around, people say, "What are you showing me this for?" It's a difference in what our diet is. We do not deal with personal death in this century. We, if your mother dies, a relative dies, I'm sorry to hear about it. I hope you can make it to work day after tomorrow. The violent death, crime is expected. The natural personal death is not. And I'm really trying to make that part of life.
Well, Dr. Stanley Burns, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Stanley Burns edited the book Sleeping Beauty, Memorial Photography in America. It's published by 12 Trees Press. This is Fresh Air. Here's a look at what's coming up later on All Things Considered. Elizabeth Arnold reports from Capitol Hill on today's Senate vote on Robert Gates to head the CIA. From London, Michael Goldfarb reports on Serbia's rejection of the European Community's peace plan. That rejection could lead to economic sanctions against the Serbian government. NPR's Mike Schuster examines the latest step in the dismantling of the Soviet Union. Yesterday, the State Council of the Soviet Union decided to abolish 70 government ministries, a move that will put as many as 50,000 bureaucrats out of work. And reporter Bob Garfield travels to New York City to meet Mr. Apology. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Life has many hard lessons. According to linguist Jeff Nunberg, some of the earliest and most painful are subtly conveyed in our first English composition classes.
There's a charming sequence in Barry Levinson's recent film Avalon about growing up in Baltimore in the early 50s. The young boy Michael is having his first grammar lesson.
Can is whether you're capable of doing something. May is asking for permission. Yes, Michael?
Can I go to the bathroom?
Michael, do you want to repeat that question?
Oh, no, I'm going to make an example.
Michael?
I said, can I go to the bathroom?
You can, but you may not.
Well, can I or can't I?
I don't think you've been paying attention to this lesson, have you, Michael Kay?
Yes, I have.
So, how would you rephrase the question?
Can I please go to the bathroom?
The teacher sends Michael into the hall to ponder the mysteries of English grammar. The principal finds him there, brings the boy to his office, and the boy's immigrant grandfather is sent for.
What's the problem? He asked to go to the bathroom.
He asked, but he asked incorrectly.
You raised his hand, didn't he?
Yes, he did, Mr. Kraczynski, but the point is, it was a lesson about May and Ken.
Okay, it's fine with me. So what's the problem?
He asked, can I go to the bathroom? The teacher said, you can, but you may not.
That's confusing to the kid. Because you're saying you can, and then you say, you can, but you can't.
I don't think you understand the subtleties of the English language, Mr. Kraczynski.
The story's apocryphal, of course. But that doesn't mean it's false. That's what schools are there for, to reenact the apocrypha for each generation. I have no doubt that this really happened to Barry Levinson when he was growing up in Baltimore. I know for sure it happened to Dwayne Bernheimer in New York in 1953, when he and I were in the third grade together. I can still see the little smile twitching around the corners of Mrs. Rooney's mouth when Dwayne handed her the setup line. And I'm willing to bet that even as we speak, there are children sitting in classrooms in Philadelphia and Fresno with their eyebrows furrowed and their knees pressed together while the teacher says to them, yes, Kimberly, or yes, Jesus, or yes, Hiroko, you can go to the bathroom, but you may not. What makes the can-may business so difficult, anyway? It's supposed to be a matter of politeness. But my just barely 2-year-old is already saying thank you whenever you give her something, or for that matter, whenever she gives you something. And 3-year-olds are already the masters of please in 1,000 incantations. But can and may isn't about politeness. It's the first lesson in the grammar of institutional power. After all, in real life, it's only institutions that tell us what we may do. Employees may switch benefit plans at any time within the first 30 days. Jurors may not speak with the press. But you don't expect to hear a friend tell you, you may ride to the party with us. Civil people don't make a point of giving permission. It's a tough concept for an 8-year-old mind to grasp. And even if we all get it sooner or later, it comes at a price. From that time on, we feel a twitching of sphincters whenever the subject of grammar is raised.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. If you have any comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, and Amy Sallet, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
For years, Garrison Keillor has been one of the most popular people on radio. Now he's written a new novel about the early days of radio. On the next Fresh Air, Garrison Keillor reads from his new novel and talks with us about his early days on radio. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.